You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Carrie Nolan, in for Leonard LoPate. John Podesta was assistant to the president and White House chief of staff under President Bill Clinton. He's now president of the Center for American Progress and a visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center. His new book, The Power of Progress, How America's Progressives Can, Once Again, Save Our Economy, Our Climate, and Our Country, offers solutions to the problems America faces as we approach the presidential election. It's published by Crown, and I'm very pleased that it brings John Podesta to the Leonard LoPage Show today. Welcome. I guess we're sort of missing John Podesta here. We're going to have a couple of little gremlins in the machine. We'll get that sorted out in a little while. John Podesta starts his book with lessons from our progressive past, and I thought we would talk a little bit about that, also about Presidents Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt and Wilson, and what they did in terms of making government more of a, enhancing national power for the betterment of individuals and society, things like that. And I'm curious about what you think of progressive politics. What's the difference between a progressive and a liberal? Are progressive politics the way the country needs to go? Give us a call and let us know what your thoughts are on this at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. We're waiting to get connected with John Podesta, president of the Center for American Progress, who's written a new book called The Power of Progress, How America's Progressives Can, Once Again, Save Our Economy, Our Climate, and Our Country. How we doing? Have we, don't have him yet. Okay. Alrighty. 212-433-9692 is the number. Franklin Roosevelt was, according to Mr. Podesta, an upper-class reformer who started off conservative and steadily moved left. He's famously, and in a somewhat exaggerated fashion, referred to as a trust buster who called out the malefactors of great wealth. So, what happens today? Why are there no progressives? Why has the progressive message been drowned out by other messages? And what can we do about it? John Podesta joins us now. Hi, thanks for being here.
Hi, can you hear me? Hello?
I'm sorry, I can't hear Mr. Podesta at all. This is WNYC in New York. We're having some serious problems with our hookup for author John Podesta, The Power of Progress, his book. We're going to take a quick break and see if we can sort this stuff out. This is The Leonard LoPage Show on WNYC. I'm Carrie Nolan, in for Leonard LoPate, and we're having some trouble getting John Podesta on the line here.
Hello.
This is what happens, Mr. Podesta. You've joined us. Thank you so much for being here.
How are you?
Oh, we're well, better now. Now that you're with us, thanks for being here.
I put my finger in the electric socket, and that seemed to work.
Whatever it takes, you know. your book, The Power of Progress, you talk a bit about lessons from our progressive past. But before I get into those lessons with you, how do you define the term progressive versus liberal? What's the difference?
Well, I draw out a couple of distinctions, but mostly I think historically – there was a moment in which progressive politics really grew up in the turn of the 20th century, the late 19th century, turn of the 20th century. It really was that spirit that I was trying to associate with. It was a spirit of reform when progressives were engaged in a search for social and economic justice, a bit different from the provenance, if you will, from the history of liberalism, which goes back to the Enlightenment, which was concerned itself with the protection of human dignity. I think Franklin Roosevelt brought the concepts together, and I certainly don't mind being labeled a liberal, but I think that America has a unique history in creating the concept of progressivism, which focused on opportunity for working people, building out the middle class, focusing on the common good, and attacking narrow self-interest and special interests. And it had that spirit of reform and experimentation that we associate with, you know, Bob La Follette and Teddy Roosevelt in the Republican Party, Franklin Roosevelt in the Democratic Party. And so I find the roots of that in my own experience and in my own life. So I wanted to associate with that.
It seems to me that over the last couple of years, I've heard the word progressive used as a substitute for a liberal, probably because the word liberal has taken on such, negative overtones as from, from right-wing radio and right-wing media.
Yeah, and you know, some people might think that, but again, as I said, I certainly don't mind being called a liberal, but I think that finding our roots in those values that those early reformers had, thinking about the way they changed this country, built the middle class, won two world wars, created a great country that was a leader of the world, built the international architecture that kept the country safe for so many years, is a proud history, and we should be proud of it. And it is, by its nature, I think, comes from reform inside both parties, so it's less partisan in nature. So I found that as I went back in history and thought about today's problems and the challenges that we need to face today and the solutions that we need to face, that looking at those early progressives in the turn of the 20th century was an important historical reference. Progress is in itself a term that I think that Americans really understand and grab onto, going from a conservative status quo to a better tomorrow is something that's important. And so, that's why I chose to call the book The Power of Progress, and that's why I view myself as a progressive.
We're talking with John Podesta, former White House Chief of Staff and the author of the new book, The Power of Progress. You say in the book, and I mentioned this just before when we were trying to iron out our issues, the presidencies of Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Franklin Roosevelt exemplify the progressive tradition of enhancing national power for the betterment of individuals and society. And then on the other hand, you have someone like Grover Norquist, who famously said that he wanted to shrink government so that it's small enough to drown in a bathtub. And you kind of wonder whether the part of the role of government, isn't it to provide some kind of safety net for those people who can't take care of themselves and to help everybody do a little bit better?
Well, it seems to me that Grover Norquist ought to take a bus and go to New Orleans and stand in front of the victims of Katrina and see what his theory wrought when it really came time for people who believed in government and for people who needed government to come face to face with the kind of challenge that we saw in Katrina. I think more broadly, the conservative experiment that Mr. Norquist so famously trumpets has been a failure for the American people during the period of the Bush presidency. We've seen a focus on just helping the very wealthiest Americans and the special interests. And what's happened? Weekly wages are lower than they were 10 years ago. Family incomes dropped $1,000 during the course of the Bush presidency. We've got a housing disaster. We've got debt at record levels. And I think that the both people, working people today, are going backwards, not forwards.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that widening gap between the rich and the poor. What kind of policy changes would you like to see put in place that would make the middle class more secure?
Well, I think I lay out a number in the book. I think first we need a fairer tax policy, one that's focused not on simply favoring capital income, but that really is balanced to so that people who are working for their wages have a better shot at living the American dream. That's most of us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think restoration of fairness in the tax code is critical. I think investment and reform in our public education system is critical to help people succeed. Again, I note in my own journey in the book, I'm the grandson of four penniless immigrant grandparents. My father was a blue-collar worker. Based on my ability to attend decent public schools in the city of Chicago and be able to take advantage of federal programs that let me go to college, I moved up the ladder of success and was able to be chief of staff to the president of the United States. And, that's an extraordinary story, but it's also an ordinary story. It happened to millions of people during the course of the 20th century, because I think people had the vision and the foresight to say that if we invest in people from as young people in the public education system, give them the opportunities for success, they'll do amazing things.
I'm wondering your thoughts on doing, when you say restoring fairness in the tax code, when people hear the idea that their taxes may have to be raised because we're in such huge debt, it still scares them and they still run away from it. How do you convince people that, that making the tax code fairer for everyone might mean that we all have to, initially pay a little more in? I mean, that lovely surplus that President Clinton left the country with, right, was decimated within about 6 months.
Well, at some level, I think it's really about restoration of fairness. I think that the people at the top end do need to pay a little bit more and should pay a little bit more. And I think that the people, particularly the working poor in this country, need more tax relief. I call for an expanded earned income tax credit, particularly for single workers who don't have children, who have fallen more deeply into poverty than we saw in the 1990s. I think people in the middle deserve fairness by continuing strong rate reductions. I think we could get some tax relief by potentially lowering the payroll taxes that we currently face. But I think people at the top need to pay more. We've distorted the tax cuts, particularly under President Bush. I would note that that Senator McCain not only is calling for extending the Bush tax cuts, but actually adding to those, more than half of which go to the top 1% of income earners in the country, which is a far cry from the person he claims to be his hero, who it was Teddy Roosevelt, who called for graduated income tax and an inheritance tax. So I think that raising taxes on the very wealthiest Americans will increase the burden on working Americans is just wrong. We need to explain that and explain that our theory of the case is that we all do better when everybody does better. And I think, quite frankly, President Clinton and his economic program prove that fact.
John Podesta is my guest. He is the president of the Center for American Progress and the author of the new book, The Power of Progress. Let's talk a little bit about health care. It's been a major issue since President Clinton's first term, yet there hasn't been a successful plan by the federal government to provide universal health care. What do you think has to happen for a national health care plan to actually pass?
Yeah, well, I think we're in a somewhat different circumstance, in part because what's happened particularly, again, in the past several years, is that the burden on business from health care expenses has increased. The family burden is obviously shot way up, and there are more uninsured now. Today, we're back up to about 47 million uninsured people in the country, and the burden of those uninsured falls on the rest of us when they go see an emergency room, et cetera.
Sure.
So I think there's actually more. There's more broad-based business support to reform the way we're doing business, to bring everybody into the system, to try to begin to have more cost-effective treatment options, to focus on keeping people healthy, through, you know, wellness programs and disease management, which will overall lower the cost of health care across the board in the country. You know, we pay about 16% of our total GDP for health care costs in America. And the next highest country, which is Switzerland, pays about 10%. And we're actually not getting the return. We have some of the best health care in the world. But if you look at the public health statistics, we're not doing that well. So we need a reform system. And I think, again, I think we'll find that it's not just the people who are uninsured who need relief, but it's people who have insurance but can't afford it or are, you know, one illness away from bankruptcy, along with, again, a broad level of business leadership that says, look, this system isn't working for us. We got to change the status quo. We can't just keep listening to the single voices of the insurance industry. We've got to try to find a new way to get everyone into the system to provide affordable quality coverage. So I think the politics has changed, and I think there's some ideas out there that were put forward in the campaign by the Democratic candidates and which now Senator Obama has on the table, which are practical, which keep people with the insurance coverage they have if they like it, but give them better options if they want to move to more affordable options and provide the right kind of support for people, particularly at the low end of the income scale, to get affordable coverage. And I'm rather optimistic that this will be tackled again. And this time, we've been after this for a long time. President Johnson obviously made a big progress on this by passing Medicare and Medicaid. Mm-hmm. But I'm rather optimistic that this time around we can get bipartisan support and move this forward.
I wonder if it really has to start from the state level and work its way to the federal level rather than being a top-down kind of thing, you know, the way Massachusetts has structured its health care plan.
I think, I think there's a legitimate argument about that, and maybe what the federal government needs to do is to essentially incentivize those kind of programs. And I think the Massachusetts program is at least the people in Massachusetts are pretty satisfied with what's going on. It's cost a little bit more than they anticipated, but people seem to like what and the reason it's cost a little bit more because there were more uninsured people in Massachusetts than people realized, and more people have come into the system. But I think that people like it. I think it has strong support inside the state. But the counterexample is what happened in California, in which the state couldn't do it on its own. It really needed, I think, federal support. Governor Schwarzenegger tried to work with the legislature to try to get universal coverage there. They couldn't quite get the job done. And I think it's going to take a federal effort conceivably implemented in a regional or a state-by-state basis, but it's going to take a federal effort for us to really move the ball forward. It's going to take those kind of resources, and I think the capacity of the federal government to really drive the research that's needed to show where cost-effective medicine can really help lower the overall cost of health care in the country.
Well, let's move over to another touchy subject. The conservatives have very successfully used religion, notably evangelical Christianity, to inform their policy and build their base of supporters. Is there a place for religion or faith in progressive politics?
Sure, there always has been. I think if you look back at all the great movements in this country, from the founding of the country to the movement for abolition of slavery to women's suffrage to civil rights, there's always been a strong prophetic voice on the side of moving the country to a place of greater justice, greater freedom, and that's come from deep within the religious community. I'm a liberal Catholic, but I relate to Catholic social doctrine, to the way in which the a church relates to poor people in this country and around the globe. And I think that's important to many people in this country, and there ought to be a place in the public square for the expression of that. As my friend Jim Wallace, the head of Sojourners, likes to say, can you imagine the civil rights movement without the voice of Martin Luther King Jr.? I mean, a prophetic religious voice occupies a almost central role in the progress that this country's made. And again, if you look back to the period, which again I spend a good deal of time on in the book, the turn of the century and the rise of progressive politics, you saw this. It was highly influenced by people like Jane Addams at Hull House, who was herself, motivated by religious concern, by the social gospel movement at the turn of the century, which has become back in vogue in Protestant religions, by the deformation of Catholic social doctrine around that time to deal with the very great wealth that was being created by industrialization, but the very great poverty that sat alongside, and the call for social change that resulted from that. So, I think that the tapestry of religion in this country is much more complex than the media made it out to be for the last several years, that to be religious was to be conservative. I don't believe that, and I think there are millions of other believing Americans who don't believe that. And I think we've probably through the course of this campaign, actually, we've gotten to something of a better place in understanding that you don't have to wear your religion on your sleeve to be in politics, but that religious values can motivate important social change.
I'm Carrie Nolan, sitting in for Leonard Lopate here on WNYC in New York. You can also find us online, by the way, at WNYC.org. We're talking with John Podesta, who is the former White House Chief of Staff. His new book, The Power of Progress, is published by Crown. Let's turn to yet another hot-button issue here, environmental policy. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about some conservation issues. There's the idea of offshore drilling has been in the news and seems to some people like a very short-term solution to a long-term problem. And then Barack Obama seems to have somewhat shifted his stance on offshore drilling. At first he was very much opposed to it. Now he's not entirely opposed to it.
Well, I think that what the country needs to be what needs to get onto is clean, renewable, alternative energy. And I think that the drilling debate is a bit of a diversion. We're going to continue to depend on oil in the short term. But if this takes our eye off the ball of getting onto clean alternative energies, we're not going to only not solve the oil dependency we have today. We're going to not only keep ourselves in hock to hostile regimes overseas, but we're not going to tackle what I think is the looming crisis for our country and the planet, which is the problem of climate change. So if it can there be a somewhat more drilling and done in a sustainable way? I suppose so. In the short term, we already have 68 million of acres of leased land, most of which is in offshore, that isn't even being drilled on today, that's been leased by the oil companies. But I think what we really need to do is get on to a wholly different energy solution, not one that's based on oil, but that's based on clean, renewable alternative energies that won't pollute the environment, will preserve our planet for future generations. And again, in that, I take inspiration from Teddy Roosevelt.
How do you respond to the complaints that it's too expensive for corporations to switch to cleaner energy?
I think that they got their economics exactly backwards. I think that this country has always been built around innovation. It's always been built around new technology. Again, embedded in the term progress itself is that spirit of technological change and movement. And I think that what this country will do if it moves towards an agenda of transforming the economy from a high carbon base to a low carbon base, is it will unleash the ingenuity of the American people. It'll put people back to work. It'll create a virtuous cycle of investment in efficiency. And I think that what that will end up doing is power the economy forward rather than hold it back. I think the people who I'll give you an analogy for that, which is what ended up happening in the information technology sector when we opened up the architecture of communications, when we allowed application to occur over the internet. We unleashed a torrent of new ideas, of innovation, of new businesses, of new investment, and that's exactly, I think, what can happen if we release the hammer lock that the fossil fuel industry has on our energy infrastructure and move towards clean and alternative energies. And you know, you see that happening in California and Florida and other places around the country.
The issue of conservation, of course, isn't just about slowing climate change. It's also, in our case, about national security. Now, what do you see? You talk about creating sustainable security. What do you think President Bush's security policies are not sustainable? Why, rather?
Well, look, I think he veered very far off course, got away from the values of the country. I think that the preemptive unilateral war in Iraq was a strategic disaster. I think that, you know, we replaced the picture of the Statue of Liberty with a picture at Abu Ghraib as a lasting image around the globe. If you look at where the country stands with respect to the respect that the United States has around the globe, it almost universally went down. He didn't attend to the alliances that proved so important and so effective for us during the course of the second half of the 20th century, and I think he left us in a position in which we're weaker rather than stronger. Almost all the big global challenges we face, whether it's terrorism or proliferation, whether it's the tremendous insecurity that could come and will come from global warming and climate change, whether that's the problems of mass migration or food insecurity, water insecurity, the issues around infectious diseases and new diseases that spread across the globe that affect our economy and affect our security. None of those can be tackled by the United States as a kind of fortress unto itself. None of them virtually can be tackled with military power. They need sophisticated approaches that combine diplomacy, law enforcement, intelligence, and cooperation to meet those challenges. And I think that that President Bush got almost all of that wrong. Followed a kind of neoconservative approach that basically said that the United States can be above the law, go it alone, and force everybody into submission. And I think we see, you know, the consequences around the globe in a war that's cost us $1 trillion in Iraq and left us weaker as a result.
Now, this, of course, leads into my next question, which is about the expansion of presidential powers in the last 8 years. As a progressive, where do you stand on that?
Well, I think the balance between the separation of powers got completely out of whack. The president, you know, I served a president. I served in the White House. I understand the needs of a president to have the ability to take action when necessary in defense of the country, et cetera. But I think that the approach that President Bush and particularly Vice President Cheney pushed forward, the so-called unitary executive, which, you know, some neocon scholar thought up that basically said that the president uber alles more than the judiciary, more than the Congress, more than the people of the United States was wrong for the country. It bred a culture of secrecy. It led them to deal with impunity, to distort intelligence in terms of the ability to convince the American people what the real threats facing the country were. It caused them to ignore legitimate inquiries from the Congress. And I think if a progressive is elected president, as I hope and suspect one will be in November, I hope they'll reverse course on that and restore a level of openness and effectiveness to our government, and respect the fact that president is a powerful figure in our system, but that checks and balances are necessary for any large institution, and it was the genius of the founders of our Constitution to provide that inside the Constitution, and they need to be respected.
Do you consider Barack Obama a true progressive?
Yes, I think that Barack Obama, by disposition and by program, is a true progressive. You know, I talk a lot about growing up in Chicago and Chicago as a kind of a place that reflects a lot that's great about America, and some things that are not so great about America, but mostly things that are great about America. And I one of the things that I note about the early progressive history is that, and I mentioned Jane Addams, is that the community activism that was part of progressive politics, what really made the progressive experiment happen, he finds, I think, strong roots in his own politics from his experience of having gone to Chicago and worked as a community organizer and seeing the capacity to make change at that level, but understanding that in order for big change to happen, that had to be embedded in policy solutions and political solutions that were adopted by cities and by states and ultimately by the national government. And I think that's what drew him to Washington and now causes him to run for president. And obviously the idea that that we have moved along a progression, I think built around a progressive ideas that a person of color could not only be running for president, but be the front runner for the office of the president is something that I think that progressives in America ought to really take some great pride in.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it. John Podesta, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
John Podesta is the former White House Chief of Staff, currently the president of the Center for American Progress, and the author of the new book, The Power of Progress, How America's Progressives Can, Once Again, Save Our Economy, Our Climate, and Our Country. It's published by Crown.